Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Kelly Jean Kelly, Anne Ball, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Kelly Jean Kelly.
Leah Chase, who died this month, was an American civil rights activist and chef in New Orleans, Louisiana. Her restaurant is well known. It serves people from all walks of life, from local men and women to famous personalities, such as baseball player Hank Aaron and singer Beyoncé. Two other customers, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, served as President of the United States. But people who never visited the restaurant likely still know Chase, sort of. She was a main inspiration for Princess Tiana in the Disney movie The Princess and the Frog. Chase's name at birth was Leah Lang. She was born in 1923 in Louisiana. At that time, many places in the southern states were segregated. In other words, people were divided by race and skin color. In her town, children with light skin went to one school. Children with dark skin went to another. The schooling for children with dark skin stopped after 6 years. So her parents sent their daughter to New Orleans, the largest city in the state, to complete her education at a Catholic high school. A report in the New York Times newspaper says she was a gifted student and finished at age 16. Soon after, she began working as a waitress at a top restaurant for white people in the city's historic French Quarter. There, she became interested in fine dining, high-quality food in a beautiful space. In time, Leah Lang married a musician whose family owned a restaurant. He and the restaurant were both named after his father, Dookie Chase. Dookie Chase's at that time was an easygoing shop where black people could buy sandwiches and lottery tickets. But Leah Chase had other ideas. She added white tablecloths and Creole food that mixed French, Spanish, African, and other traditions. In time, Dookie Chase's became the city's first top restaurant for black visitors and locals. To many, it was a place to celebrate special events, a winning sports team, success in school, or a night with someone special, a writer from New Orleans told the New York Times. It was also a place where civil rights leaders, such as Thurgood Marshall and Martin Luther King Jr., came. They were fighting for equality among people of all races and colors. Dookie Chase's became known as a place where activists could meet and plan campaigns. The restaurant broke local segregation laws by letting black and white customers sit together. Chase said simply, she did what she thought she had to do. In the early 2000s, a group of writers were seeking ideas for a movie about a princess in New Orleans. They easily found Leah Chase, says a report in The Oprah magazine. Chase said, "She spoke to the film's writers for hours about her life. In time, the Disney movie, The Princess and the Frog, told the story of a hard-working African-American waitress who dreams of owning a restaurant." "Now everybody wants to be Tiana," Chase told the magazine in 2010. "I think it's fantastic." Leah Chase continued to work and serve others well into old age. She published cookbooks and collected paintings by African-American artists. She met with customers and supervised the restaurant's kitchen. She said, "Food helped people feel better." She told the Associated Press, "Sometimes people will come in and they're tired, and just a little plate of food will make people happy." Leah Chase died on June 1st at the age of 96. She and her husband of 70 years had 4 children, 16 grandchildren, and 28 great-grandchildren. Earlier this week, Chase's family released a statement to reporters. They called Chase a supporter of civil liberties and a believer in the spirit of New Orleans. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Samantha Fish is an American songwriter and blues singer. In her song, "Somebody's Always Trying," she complains about other unnamed women. She accuses them of trying to take her boyfriend away from her. Today, we will explore the grammar behind the words from this song. To be more exact, we will explore how English speakers use the progressive tense to show dissatisfaction or make a complaint. But first, we will provide a few helpful definitions.
Simple verbs are the most common kinds of verbs in conversation. English speakers often use the simple present tense when talking about repeated or common everyday activities. For example, you might hear a child say, "I study for 1 hour every day." Often, English speakers direct your attention to the repeated nature of their statements by using the simple present tense with the adverb always. For example, an office worker might say, "I always wake up at 6 in the morning." If you would like to learn more about how English speakers use the word always, you should read another everyday grammar story on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
While English speakers often use the simple tense with always to talk about common or repeated actions, they sometimes use the progressive tense to give the same meaning. In other words, they are using progressive verbs when you might expect them to use simple verbs. In general, the progressive tense gives the idea that an action began or took place before something else. It also shows that the action is happening now and will continue for some time. The form of the progressive tense is generally be plus ing. If we were to take our earlier example of the child, he or she might say, I am studying. This means that the child began studying some time ago, is studying presently, and might continue studying for some time. However, in some situations, English speakers use the progressive tense to express anger or other forms of annoyance.
Do not fear. You can tell if the speaker is using the progressive tense in this way. When English speakers are using the progressive tense to show annoyance, they generally use the adverbs always or constantly. Now, let's listen to an example. It is from the 2008 film Happy Go Lucky. Here, English actor Eddie Marson expresses annoyance at his driving student, played by actress Sally Hawkins.
You are patronizing me. You're always patronizing me. This is what you always wanted. This is what you set out to achieve. This is the game you play.
Here, you have an example of the progressive tense used in the usual way, to talk about a present action that began sometime in the past and continues in the present. That is why Marson says, you are patronizing me. Then he uses the present progressive tense with the adverb always to express his annoyance at a series of repeated actions. His words are, you are always patronizing me.
Let's listen to a few more examples. Imagine two high school students complaining about a person. They might say this.
Do you know Todd?
Yes, he is a hard person to get along with.
How so?
Well, he's always bragging about himself.
Really?
Yeah, he's constantly trying to make other people look bad, too.
In the conversation, you heard two examples of the speaker using the present progressive to complain. He's always bragging, and he's constantly trying. Here, the speaker is showing annoyance at a series of repeated actions. Remember the lines from Samantha Fish's song? Let's listen again.
Somebody's always trying to take my baby away.
By now, you can probably tell that the song is about expressing annoyance at a repeated action. Somebody is always trying to take away her boyfriend.
To be clear, English speakers generally use the simple tense with the adverb always to talk about repeated, everyday actions. But in some cases, such as with complaining, they sometimes use the progressive. The next time you are watching films or television, listen carefully for examples of when speakers show annoyance. You can start to notice how they change between the simple tense and the progressive tense. Try to listen for the adverbs that the speakers use and make note of them. A quick note about complaining and expressing annoyance. While it is useful to understand the grammar behind such communication, we suggest that you be careful about expressing your feelings. You can read another Everyday Grammar report on that subject on our website. I'm John Russell.
And I'm Anne Ball.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The Second World War ended with the surrender of Japan in August 1945. Americans looked to their new president, Harry Truman, to lead them into a new time of peace. Truman was vice president until President Franklin Roosevelt died suddenly in the closing months of the war. Almost no one expected President Truman to be as strong a leader as Roosevelt had been. And at first, they were right. Truman had one problem after another during his first months in the White House. Truman's first big problem was the economy. Almost 2 million Americans lost their jobs as factories ended wartime production. Americans everywhere worried about what would happen next. Only a few years before, the nation had suffered through the worst economic crisis in its history. No one wanted to return to the closed banks, hungry children, and other sad memories of the Great Depression. In some ways, the economy did better after the war than many experts had predicted. Many Americans still had money they had saved during the war, and Congress passed a law designed to help people keep their jobs. The situation could have been much worse than it was. However, the economy could also have been better, much better. Almost overnight, the price of almost everything began to rise. President Truman tried to stop the increases through a special price control agency that had been created during the war. However, thousands of business people refused to follow the government price control rules. Instead, they set their own prices for goods. Store owners would tell government officials that they were obeying the price controls, but often they charged whatever they wanted for the goods they sold. Businesses were not the only ones who were refusing to obey government price controls. Organized labor did the same thing. President Truman had always been a friend of labor unions, but during the first months of his administration, he became involved in a fierce struggle with coal miners and railroad workers. The first sign of trouble came in September 1945. A group of auto workers closed down factories at the Ford Motor Company. Then, workers at General Motors went on strike. Soon, there were strikes everywhere. The oil industry, the clothing industry, the electrical industry, and more. The strikes made Truman angry. He believed the striking workers were threatening the economy and security of the United States. He became even angrier when union representatives came to the White House and refused to accept a compromise wage offer. Truman ordered the army to take over the railroads and the coal mines. Within a short time, the striking coal miners returned to work. However, the president had less success with the railroad workers. He became so angry with the unions representing them that he asked Congress to give him the power to draft all striking railroad workers into the armed forces. The rail strike finally ended, but millions of Americans lost faith in Truman's ability to lead the country and to bring people together. By late 1946, most Americans believed that the man in the White House did not know what he was doing. Truman seemed weak and unable to control events. Union members disliked him because of his strong opposition to the coal and rail strikes. Farmers opposed Truman because of the administration's effort to keep meat prices low. Conservatives did not trust the reforms that Truman promised in his speeches, and liberal Democrats watched with concern as many of Franklin Roosevelt's old advisors left the government because they could not work with Truman. In November of 1946, the people voted in congressional and state elections. The results showed they were not satisfied with Truman and his Democratic Party. Republicans won control of both houses of Congress for the first time in 18 years, and Republicans were elected governor in 25 states. The election was a serious defeat for the Democrats, but a disaster for Truman. Some members of his party even called on him to resign. Few people gave Truman much chance of winning the next presidential election in 1948. However, Harry Truman began to change in the months that followed the 1946 congressional elections. He became a stronger speaker. He showed more understanding of the powers of the presidency. And in matters of foreign policy, he began to act more presidential. This was especially so in Truman's reaction to Soviet aggression in Germany. Truman wanted to rebuild Germany, as well as the other war-torn countries of Western Europe. As we heard last week, his administration worked closely with Western European leaders to rescue their broken economies through the Marshall Plan. But the Soviets did not want to see Germany rebuild, at least not so quickly. At first, they flooded Germany with extra German currency in an effort to destroy its value. They walked out of economic conferences. And finally, in early 1948, they blocked all the roads to West Berlin. West Berlin was in communist East Germany, but not under communist control, as was East Berlin. After the war, the Allies had divided Germany in half. West Germany had a democratic government. East Germany was communist, under Soviet control. The Soviet actions in Berlin were a direct threat to the West. Truman had three difficult choices. If he did nothing, the world would think the United States was weak and unable to stop Soviet aggression. If he fought the blockade with force, he might start a third world war. But there was another choice. The Allies proposed the idea of flying tons of food, fuel, and other supplies into West Berlin. Not just once, but every day, as long as the Russians continued their blockade. It would be a difficult job. West Berlin was home to 2.5 million people. No one had ever tried to supply so large a city by air. Planes would have to take off every 3.5 minutes, day and night, to supply the people with enough food, medicine, clothing, and badly needed coal. The operation involved American C-47 and larger C-54 transport planes, along with British Lancaster, York, and Hastings aircraft. On June 26th, the first C-47s landed at Tempelhof Airport, the beginning of the great operation that was to come.
Plans called for the operation to last just a few weeks. The planes landed in the blockaded city, and local volunteers provided support on the ground. Former mechanics of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, joined Americans in servicing the aircraft. More than 20,000 Berliners worked day and night to build an additional landing field for the American and British planes. It became Tegel, now Berlin's major airport. As part of the supply effort, the British Royal Air Force even landed Sunderland flying boats on a Berlin lake. Brigadier General Joseph Smith was appointed task force commander of the American part of the airlift. General Smith called the mission Operation Vittles, using an American slang term for food. Operation Vittles also led to Operation Little Vittles, or the dropping of chocolates and other treats to children. The pilots who did this became known as candy bombers. Appreciative German children called them the Schokoladenflieger, the chocolate pilots.
They wanted to know which airplane I was in. I said, you tell my airplane on regular wings, and then you'd know that's me. Watch just that airplane. And they says, good, that's Lindenbar. I came back the next day, and I put little parachutes for the Galgumi and the Schokoladen so they could see it. And so it would hit them hard in the head, slow it down. And so I wiggled the wings, and boy, they waved their hands, and I pushed it out of the airplane. And that's how it started.
It was the idea of Gail Halverson, a pilot in the United States Air Force. Lieutenant Halverson became known as Mr. Wiggly Wings. From his plane, he would drop chewing gum and chocolates attached to tiny parachutes made from handkerchiefs. Soon, many of the airlift pilots were dropping candy from their planes, including into Soviet-controlled areas that they flew over. Americans back home supplied the handkerchiefs, and the chocolate industry supplied the treats. Years later, in Berlin, Gail Halverson told German interviewer Rolf Gründer how he got the idea.
I dropped chocolate because of gratitude. I met 30 children at the fence at Tempelhof, and not one put out their hand and says, give me more than flour, give me more than coal, give me chocolate. And they had no chocolate, they had no gum, but they would not be a beggar. They're so grateful for flour. And I said, wow. They were thankful. And when people are thankful, good things happen.
It soon became clear to the Soviets that the Berlin airlift would succeed. In May of 1949, almost 1 year after they had started their blockade, they ended it. The crisis in Berlin changed the way many Americans saw their president. Harry Truman no longer seemed so weak or unsure of himself. Instead, he was acting as a leader who could take an active part in world affairs. Truman's popularity increased. However, most Americans did not expect him to win the election in 1948. Almost everyone believed that the Republican candidate, New York Governor Thomas Dewey, would capture the office. The election campaign that year turned out to be one of the most exciting and surprising in the history of the nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.